V for Vendetta, novelization by Steve Moore, continued. Disc 8. 23. On television screens across the land, from private houses to the huge public displays in the city squares and plazas, as well as on the loudspeakers in the streets, High Chancellor Adam Sutler was making a live statement to an apparently worried nation, trying to evoke that same spirit that had carried his countrymen through the Blitz, the Battle of Britain, and so many other threats, both imminent and potential, real and imagined. Assuring them that they, and more important, he, would get through the Battle of November the 5th. Yes, there he was, still at his post, where everyone could see him, a reassuring presence no matter what danger the insidious terrorist organization called V might represent. England's great protector, the guardian of its values, its traditions, and its faith. An aging St. George, England's patron saint, called forth once more to guard the realm against the revolutionary dragon. "My fellow Englishmen," he began roundly, addressing the camera with oratorical sincerity. "Tonight, our country, that which we stand for and all that we hold most dear, faces a grave and terrible threat. This violent and unparalleled assault on our security will not go undefended or unpunished." One of the few places where no television screens were to be found was on the concourse of the old, abandoned Victoria Tube Station. So naturally, the words went unheard by Peter Creedy and two of his chosen, most trusted fingermen as they came down the steps and looked around the place. Mind you, they'd heard them earlier in the day, when the live broadcast was first recorded, and the ironic contempt they'd felt for Sutler's words at the time had only increased with the day's subsequent events. But if there was no broadcast to be heard here, there was plenty of other activity, as a number of the Fingers' heavily armed paramilitary troops, having arrived an hour or so earlier, continued to sweep the area with metal detectors and electronic scanners.
"The area's clean, sir," one of them reported,
quite unaware that somewhere down below, Finch was continuing his obsessive one-man quest. But Finch was a long way beyond the range of anyone's detection, far removed from having any part to play in the drama that was about to unfold above him. Creedy looked around at the station, unused as it had been for years, illuminated now only by a portable lantern in one corner and the flashlights of his troops. Old ticket barriers stood rusting, floor tiles had subsided unevenly, severed piping and cut electric cables hung dangling from the ceiling, and the more his men moved around, the more the clouds of musty, odorous dust rose up to choke what little air there was, making it look like one of those ridiculous, thick London fogs that Hollywood movies had always showed enshrouding the capital right up to the time when Hollywood had been bombed out of existence, even though fogs like that hadn't been seen for decades. It wasn't a pleasant place to be, even surrounded by so many of his men, and as their flashlight beams continued to slash through the darkness, Creedy had to admit to feeling far from comfortable. So many potential hiding places here, and all unlit. The old ticket office, the staff restrooms, the station manager's office, and though he knew his men would have checked them all, the very shadows still seemed threatening.
"You said 11 o'clock, Mr. Creedy,"
one of the accompanying fingermen said, feeling a touch of the same nervousness, although the place had been searched from top to bottom, and the search continued still.
"It's 11 o'clock. Where is he?"
"Penny for the guy,"
said a calm voice behind him, with just a hint of irony. The fingerman jumped, twisting round and reaching automatically for his gun. By the time it was in his hand, innumerable flashlights had picked out V, making his mask glow in the darkness like a small moon illuminating the night.
"Our enemy is an insidious one," Adam Sutler said,
in virtually every other place in the land but here.
"Seeking to divide us, and to destroy the very foundation of our great nation."
But now the insidious enemy stood calmly,
while one of the paramilitaries stepped forward with a scanner, sweeping his body swiftly for evidence of explosives.
"Nothing, sir,"
the man said at last, turning back to Creedy to report, then hurriedly moving away, back to the safety in numbers of his fellow soldiers.
"I've kept my side of the bargain," V told Creedy. "But have you kept yours?"
Creedy's smile was not even remotely pleasant.
"Tonight we must remain steadfast, we must remain determined, and most of all, we must remain united."
"Bring him down," said Creedy coldly to his companions, and knowing exactly to whom he referred, they holstered their guns and went silently and efficiently back up the stairs.
"Those caught tonight, in violation of the curfew,"
Sutler's voice continued, unaware that, especially throughout the London area, many of the television sets had been turned off and that he was addressing empty rooms,
"will be considered in league with our enemy, and will be prosecuted as terrorists, without leniency or exception."
The implication was obvious. The black bag, the plastic zip ties, the interrogation, the torture, and eventually the execution. The man the two-finger man brought down into the station was wearing a black bag himself, his arms fastened behind him. He still struggled weakly, helplessly, pointlessly, as they dropped him to his knees on the uneven floor. Whether through the pain of the impact, or because of all he'd been through so far, the man whimpered like a child. And for once, the smile on V's mask seemed fully alive rather than artificial.
"I want to see his face," he said to Creedy,
wanting to make sure at the end that there was no final deception.
"Tonight I give you my most solemn vow that justice will be swift," Sutler concluded forcefully, confidently, and ultimately smugly. "It will be righteous, and it will be without mercy."
It was Creedy himself who pulled off the black plastic bag, taking a personal, malicious pleasure in his triumph. And there was Adam Sutler. Not as he'd been appearing only seconds ago on national television, the righteous hand of God and protector of the nation, but wide-eyed with terror, with drool dribbling from his lower lip, trying to turn his head away as the flashlights shone fiercely into his face, just as so many interrogation lamps had shone into so many of his citizens' faces during the years since he'd come to power. A battered, defeated, and suddenly very old man, sick with fear, who, when his eyes finally adjusted to the mingled pattern of brilliant light and deepest shadow, managed to look round and see the face of the man before him. Or rather, to see his mask.
"Oh, God," moaned Sutler desperately. "Dear God, no!"
"At last we finally meet," V said pleasantly, as if making a long-wished-for acquaintance while kneeling down before the terrified man. The former High Chancellor of England had almost totally collapsed, staring uncomprehendingly at the man, or was it a monster, who'd tormented him for the last year, who turned his last months in office into an ever-worsening nightmare. "I have something for you, Chancellor," V continued, one hand reaching inside his cape. "A farewell gift for all the things you've done, for the things you might have done, and for the only thing you have left." With that, like a man making an offering on a tombstone, or uselessly propitiating a dead god, he laid a violet Carson rose before the kneeling captive. And Adam Sutler knew well enough what that signified, remembering the roses found with Prothero, with Lilliman, and the others. "Goodbye, Chancellor," said V, almost affectionately, as he rose to his feet.
"Oh, God, don't!"
begged Sutler, all control lost now.
"Please, please!"
Then no more words would come. And the man who had mere hours earlier been the most powerful man in one of the most powerful nations in the post-war world could only sob uncontrollably, shaking with horror. "Mr. Creedy?" asked V casually, turning to the head of the finger, stepping back a pace to give the man room to go about his business. Creedy pulled out his heavy, large-caliber revolver, the one he'd always used on the Chancellor's behalf, back in the old days when he'd been the man's Rottweiler, summoned one of his companions forward to hold his victim still, and placed the gun to Suttler's temple. He lingered there sadistically while his former boss wailed helplessly, unable even to speak any more, fouling himself in terror.
"Disgusting," said Creedy coldly, and pulled the trigger.
Bone, brain, and blood exploding from the other side of his head, High Chancellor Adam Suttler pitched forward on his face, his head turning to the side as he hit the ground. And the violet Carson rose lay a mere inch before his sightless eyes, as more blood began to leak copiously from his nose and mouth. After the echo of the gunshot had died, silence descended on the station for what seemed a considerable length of time, though in reality it was little more than seconds. The paramilitary fingermen could only stare, stunned at the suddenness and ruthlessness with which their former political leader had been so summarily executed, while both V and Creedy seemed to require a little time to savour the conclusion of one particular and highly important project before moving on to the next. Though both of them knew precisely what the next item on the agenda was likely to be.
"Now that's done with," Creedy said eventually, raising his gun as he turned toward V, aiming straight at his heart. "It's time to have a look at your face."
Following their boss's lead, the surrounding fingermen levelled their guns as well, all concentrating on the same target. But V merely stood there looking straight back at Creedy, arms folded inside his cloak, and with the conical fall of the cloth, the hat and wig and mask— For a moment it almost seemed as if there weren't a man standing there at all. As if this were merely a costume, an image, a shadow, a symbol.
"Take off your mask," Creedy commanded more firmly, almost as if V hadn't understood him the first time around.
"No," said V flatly.
"Defiant to the end," Creedy smiled. A smile that somehow mingled malice with respect, though containing rather more of the former. "You won't cry like him, will you? You're not afraid of death. You're like me."
"The only thing you and I have in common, Mr. Creedy, is that we are both about to die."
"Is that so?"
Creedy laughed, his glance widening to take in the surrounding fingermen and their weapons.
"And how do you imagine that will happen?"
"With my hands round your neck."
Creedy's body tensed then, like a trigger being pulled back.
"Bollocks," he said coldly, confidently, and all round him his men bristled like attack dogs straining at the leash, waiting for the single word that would release them, sending them leaping forward to savage their prey.
"What are you going to do, huh?" Creedy sneered contemptuously.
"We've swept this place and you've got nothing. Nothing but your bloody knives and fancy karate gimmicks, and we've got guns."
"No," V told him calmly. "What you have is 62 bullets, and the hope that when your guns are empty I'm no longer standing. Because if I am, you'll all be dead before you've reloaded."
"That's impossible," Creedy snapped.
But now there was an uncertain edge to his voice. What if it was possible? What if this was somehow something more than a man, something unkillable? And that same thought ran like wildfire through the minds of all the assembled fingermen, made their palms suddenly slick with sweat as they held their guns. For just a moment, they began to look more at each other than their enemy.
"Kill him,"
Creedy barked then, only just before hesitation turned into something worse. The words were barely out of his mouth before they were drowned in an explosive cacophony of gunfire, the rattle of automatics mingling with the bark of Creedy's revolver. Time seemed to slow in a repeated thunder of gunpowder booms and whistling lead, mingled with a whine of ricocheting bullets, but not with the sound of a falling body. V's body jerked back, the majority of the bullets disappearing into the black folds of his cloak, obviously finding their target, for otherwise he wouldn't have to keep readjusting his footing to cope with the continual impacts. Other bullets sparked off his mask, which,
unlike the thousands of papier-mâché copies he'd distributed to the public, was this time made of steel. Even so, each impact jerked his head from side to side with the force of a hammer blow. Yet still he stood, absorbing visible punishment yet resisting the obvious pain, stood like a monument to human endurance, to the triumph of mind over matter, to the power of the will. At last there was only the fading echo of gunfire, followed by silence as the automatics locked open, the revolver span to click on empty chambers. And still V remained on his feet, swaying slightly, but still on his feet. A moment for silent prayer, that V might suddenly collapse like a house of cards, that they might wake up from this nightmare safe beside their wives or girlfriends, or that the God in which so few of them truly believed might suddenly prove real after all and strike this devil down. But the cloaked figure still stood there, and the mask continued to smile. "My turn," said V, his words as chill and final as the words of death himself. A soft sound of rattling metal filled the station as the fingermen, suddenly snapping out of their horrified trance, began trying to reload their guns, before V was among them, moving with the silence of a wind-driven cloud, the swiftness of a darting hawk. The first fingerman barely had time to react to the 8 inches of cold steel that pierced his heart, before the knife was twisted and removed, the exit wound hideous, the long jet of arterial blood rising scarlet before his horrified eyes. A fierce spray of crimson lifeblood that somehow unmanned his companions completely, making fingers seem like rubber, making bullet clips as slippery as soap. And before the first had hit the floor, a second fingerman had dropped his bullet clip as the same knife opened up his throat, a swift, silvery blade that moved like greased lightning, and wherever that lightning struck, the blood showered down like rain. V's cloak billowed behind him then, so swift his movement, like a giant black manta ray gliding from shadow to shadow, from death to death. After that first heart stab, so demoralizing in its effect, it was always the throat. Quickest, surest, deadliest. One or two of the men, realizing there would never be time again for bullets, tried to grapple with him, but V's motions were so supernaturally fast, a long-forgotten byproduct of the Larkhill experiments, that powerful kicks drove them away in the same instant that his hands were still about their deadly business elsewhere, and in the end, whatever they did could only slightly delay the inevitable knife-work to come. Circling round the junior fingermen, carving, slicing, occasionally puncturing, always moving on as the blood began to gush and the body tumble, V was obviously saving Creedy until the last. And fighting to keep his hands steady, Creedy could only try to keep one eye on V, the other on reloading his revolver. But for every chamber he managed to fill, another of his men died a horrific, gurgling death. Finally, there were no empty chambers, and none of his men to back him up. And V was still not yet dead. He stood there with the bodies of the fingermen scattered around him, each one every bit as dead as Sutler. And then, as he turned back toward Creedy himself, astonished his opponent by suddenly dropping his knives. And then V began to walk toward him.
"No!"
yelled Creedy, terrified by now, unable to understand what had happened, was happening still, raising his reloaded pistol again and firing, his trigger finger jerking compulsively.
"Die!"
he screamed, emptying the chambers one by one, his aim deliberate, with every single bullet right on target.
"Die! Die! Die!"
Still V kept coming on, shaken by each individual impact, every step another bullet closer to Creedy's last, and finally, once again, the hammer clicked on an empty chamber.
"Why won't you die?"
gasped Creedy in disbelief, gun suddenly hanging limply from his hand, staggering now almost as much as V himself.
"Beneath this mask there is more than flesh,"
V told him, a rough edge to his voice now, but still coming on implacably, unstoppably, a living god of death. And Creedy could only back away in appalled horror, retreating step by step, and matching V's advance,
until at last his back slammed up sickeningly against the wall, and there was nowhere else to go.
"Beneath this mask there is an idea, Mr. Creedy," V said, looming over him. And now, with the ever-smiling mask pressing closer and closer to his face, terror at last overcame Creedy, robbed him of his ability to move, of his voice, of his very will to live. "And ideas are bulletproof."
Creedy started to scream then, those final words of explanation still ringing in his ears, and V's gloved hands settled round his throat as he'd promised, as almost seemed foreordained. Hands that, as they began to squeeze, choked off the scream, choked off thought, crushed his windpipe, made his eyes begin to bulge, eyes that never left that awful grinning mask, the smiling death's head that would see him to his grave. Eventually his face went dark, his tongue began to protrude, and then his eyes rolled up, and his breathing stopped forever. And still V continued to squeeze, now gone far beyond the point of making sure, his hands locked in a spasm that was only finally broken when Creedy's inert body began to slide limply down the wall. Gasping in a deep breath, V turned away then, surveying his night's work. A scatter of dead bodies in a grimy, derelict underground station that still resonated with the violence of his deeds, awash with blood and reeking with the smell of gun smoke. A dead dictator, the man who'd thought to replace him, gone as well. The totalitarian body politic just about decapitated. Worth all the sacrifices, no doubt, but what of the cost? V's gloved hands were still held up clawed before him, and he had to wait long seconds further before he finally regained their use. Staggering almost drunkenly, he made his way over to the wall, supporting himself with one hand and reaching beneath the cloak with the other. The hand didn't seem to want to work properly, and he sagged momentarily and had to prop himself up again before, finally, his fingers found the hidden clasp and flipped it open. Then, wearily, painfully, he drew out the thin metal vest that had surrounded his chest. Virtually the entire surface was pocked and dented, where the bullets had smashed into it from short range with horrifying force. Worse, in several places it was quite plainly punctured. Holes formed, he suspected, by the heavier-calibered bullets of Creedy's revolver. He looked at it briefly, the smile on the mask of the face somehow almost rueful, as he saw the inside of the vest smeared with blood. Then there was nothing else to do but let it slip from his limp fingers. As it fell, rattling to the floor, he turned away and staggered off wearily into the darkness, back into the shadows from which he'd first emerged, and leaving behind a trail of wet, bloody footprints. 24. Standing by the armoured personnel carrier that was serving as his mobile HQ, General William Byrd felt confident that he had the situation under control, even if the politicians did seem to be running scared. He was positioned in the middle of Parliament Square, surrounded by his best men, and the whole area was cordoned off and evacuated. All the streets leading toward the square were blocked, including Whitehall, Millbank, and Victoria Street, and Westminster Bridge was closed as well. There were patrol boats on the Thames, tanks in the side streets, surface-to-air missiles in the square. Farther away, where they wouldn't confuse the issue, helicopters hovered above the streets, ready to give warning of any incoming aerial threat. Westminster Abbey, the great Victorian neo-Gothic pile that was Barry and Pugin's Houses of Parliament, and the clock tower containing Big Ben, were all illuminated with their usual night-time floodlighting, and in the square itself, everything was made almost as bright as day by giant Klieg lights brought in specially for the purpose. And there were his men, too. Hand-picked commando units from the Royal Marines, with a tactical unit from the SAS specially trained in handling terror attacks. Of course, mingled with them were those blasted upstarts from the Finger. But sometimes one just had to put up with political interference in military matters. He'd rather have had more ordinary police. At least those blighters were used to obeying orders.
with fingermen you never knew where you were. Could do anything. Even if that unpleasant bastard Peter Creedy had given him assurances that the fingermen would be under his temporary command. Not that the General had much confidence in that. Creedy was well known for saying one thing and doing another. He'd expected him here tonight, along with that other nobody—what was his name? The one who looked as if he got his clothes from a charity shop. Eric Finch. Still, Bird thought, with this sort of firepower assembled here, he'd like to see those goddamned terrorists try anything tonight. Oh, yes, indeed. He'd show them. Nobody was going to make this 5th of November a night to remember. Not while William Byrd was in command. And anyway, what were they going to do to a building the size of Parliament? 1,000 rooms or more, he'd been told, and any sort of aerial attack on a place like that would only cause minor damage. Unless it was nuclear, of course. But this blighter V wouldn't have invited anyone here to watch if he was going to use something like that. No. The only way to bring down a place like that would be to attack the foundations, and all the experts had said it was going to come from the air. Had to believe the experts. Most of them were military men, after all, and anyway, that was what they'd prepared for. So that was the way it would have to be, wouldn't it? A man doesn't keep his job unless he's on the ball, does he? A slight cough to gain his commander's attention, and then Lieutenant Dowland was there before him, snapping off a crisp military salute and waiting for permission to speak. Bird nodded slowly.
"Patrols are confirming that people are in the streets, sir,"
Dowland said promptly, though there seemed to be a hint of unease in his voice.
"Then tell them to arrest them," Bird told him shortly.
Hadn't his orders been plain enough? Dowland was a good man, but surely there was no need to come running and reporting every little detail like this. That was what you had officers for, so you could delegate the authority to them. Let them get on with it. Use their own initiative.
"They say they can't," Dowland told him hesitantly.
"What?"
exploded Bird. Never heard anything so ridiculous in his life. They were soldiers in the British Army, weren't they? Ought to be able to arrest a few civilians without any problems.
"Why?"
"They say—"
his lieutenant didn't really want to say it, but knew he'd have to in the end.
"They say there are too many of them."
Evie Hammond was still sitting on a bench in the station, looking at the train that had now become such an important part of her inheritance, uncertain what to do. So beautiful on the outside, so deadly on the inside. Would she actually release that brake lever? Obviously it was what V had intended, had wanted all along, but what of the consequences? And why, at the last moment, had he suddenly become so uncertain to pass the decision on to her? She'd been over it time and again, and still wasn't exactly certain why, and the longer he was away, and the more time she had to think, the less she was able to make up her mind. Or maybe, considering how plain it had seemed to her when he'd first mentioned passing on the responsibility, it was that she was continuing to think about his motives as a way of putting off having to make the decision herself. Her train of thought was suddenly broken by a soft sound. Then another. She wasn't quite sure what it was at first. After all, she was sure no one else would be down here. And then she recognized the noises as footsteps. But somehow they were uncertain, faltering footsteps. Leaping to her feet, she called,
"V?"
He stepped out of the shadows then, holding himself stiffly upright, an arm wrapped round his chest. And she was so relieved to see him, so delighted at his return, she hardly noticed the difficulty with which he seemed to be walking.
"You came back,"
she said, smiling radiantly, full of hope and happiness.
"I was hoping you'd still be—"
he managed to say weakly. And then, after tottering one more step, he crumpled to the floor, almost as if the man himself were still elsewhere, and only the costume had made it back.
"V!"
she cried in alarm, rushing toward him and kneeling by his side. She tried to roll him over to see what was the matter, but as soon as she did, she found her hands covered in blood.
"Oh, no!"
she moaned, horrified, trying desperately to think what to do.
"We have to stop your bleeding,"
she said next, though she was uncertain how. Perhaps if his cloak could be bound round his wounds. She could only curse herself for never having taken first aid lessons, but she doubted that even first aid would be able to do anything about the wounds that V was suffering from.
What he needed was hospital treatment, and immediate treatment at that. But that would only be followed by execution anyway.
"Please,
don't," V told her weakly, a hand clutching spasmodically at her arm as she took his head in her hands, moving a knee beneath him to pillow the back of his neck.
"I'm finished. And glad for it."
"Don't say that," she told him,
knowing she didn't want it to be true as much for her own sake as for his.
"I told you. Only truth," he added,
knowing far better than she the extent and seriousness of his wounds.
"V,"
she said, unable to keep a sob out of her voice.
"I don't want you to die."
"That,"
his voice lowered almost to a whisper now,
"is the most beautiful thing you could have ever given me."
A tremor ran through his body, and he gripped her arm all the more tightly, as if it was the last thing he had to cling to, as if by doing so he clung to life itself, but quite plainly, not for long.
"For 20 years I saw only this moment,"
he gasped, his voice so weak now she had to lean close to hear it.
"Nothing else existed until I saw you. Then everything changed. My life, my reasons, my wishes."
And Evie could only hold him in her arms and weep.
"I fell in love with you, Evie, like I no longer believed I could. And every day that drew this day closer made me understand that it wasn't blood I wanted. It was another chance."
"Chance for what?"
she asked tearfully.
"For roses."
No more than the faintest whisper now.
"Not for me. For all of us."
"Oh, V!"
A last call of his name, or at least of the only name by which she'd ever known him, ever would know him. An enigma to the very end, his body suddenly grew heavy in her arms, relaxing now into the peace of death.
"V?"
she asked softly, realizing but still not wanting to accept what had happened. But at last she had to. Already underground, already deep in the underworld, V had started his final journey to the land of death. And she, left behind, could only wail desolately, as women have always wailed for their men, her mournful cries echoing through the dark emptiness of the deserted station. In Parliament Square, General Byrd had decided to inspect the perimeter personally, summoning Dowland to accompany him. People in the streets didn't sound overly threatening, but they shouldn't be there, and they could always be a cover for something else that was about to happen. Best to check and be prepared for any eventuality, make sure the men were on their toes as well. They began to circle slowly from Westminster Bridge round to Whitehall, finding everything in the immediate area as quiet as they'd expected, and moved on then to Great George Street, the short road that led through massive, overbearing buildings to St. James's Park. Not enough lights here, Byrd thought to himself, wondering if they could move some equipment from a less necessary position elsewhere. Maybe over by the Abbey, but that had its own lights after all. He was still thinking of this when he noticed Dowland jerk with sudden surprise. He looked round first toward his lieutenant, and then to what the man himself was staring at.
"It's him!"
Dowland shouted, pointing off into the shadows toward a white, grinning face.
"What?"
choked Byrd, reaching automatically toward the holstered pistol at his waist. He hadn't expected this. A plane, a missile, perhaps even a salvo of mortar bombs to open the attack, but not the terrorist himself, walking quite blatantly toward the assembled troops. But it was undoubtedly a man in a Guy Fawkes mask, and as the man stopped, Byrd drew the pistol, started to raise a hand to draw the attention of his men, and then froze, as he saw another mask appear out of the darkness, followed by another, and another. And then there were too many of them to count. Was this, then, the terrorist organization known as V? Surely not. For some of the masks seemed to be worn by women, and some of the masks were so low to the ground that they were obviously covering the faces of children,
and rather than weapons many of them were carrying flowers and lighted candles. All of them, though, it somehow seemed to the general, had now become, if not V himself, at least what he represented. And that didn't seem to be a terrorist. All of them had come to watch, come to wait. Overcoming her grief at last, if only for a little while, Evie Hammond had dragged V's body into the train, had laid him out, still masked, at peace upon a pyre of jerignite, surrounded by the roses he'd loved, that Valerie Page had loved as well, that had come to symbolize so much of what he'd already achieved, and everything he'd planned. She'd known that this was what she'd do as soon as he'd died there in her arms, knew that this was the last thing she could do for him, when he'd believed in this project so strongly that he'd actually been prepared to give his life for it. Now she'd finally bring his plan to fruition, and ensure that he had a personal part in it, was there right at the very last. When the play was acted out, the final curtain fallen, and, as that other tragic hero Hamlet had said, "The rest is silence." She'd give him a Viking funeral, like those old chieftains had had when they were set adrift in a blazing boat on a cold northern sea, sailing off through fire and ice to arrive at last in Valhalla. A notion he would have enjoyed, she thought, with his passion for the letter V. Though actually it was more like the hell-bound train she'd heard about in one of his favourite old blues songs, on an underground line with its destination in an inferno entirely of his own making. Just one last touch, folding his gloved hands across his chest and reaching round to pluck a violet Carson rose and place it in his fingers. A final brief kiss on the mask's lips, and then she turned away, his face still unseen. And she wouldn't look, as a last mark of respect. She stepped out of the carriage, started to make her way toward the driver's cab, but when she arrived at the door and looked within, something made her pause. One last surprise, one last small message from beyond the grave. For there, standing by the brake lever unseen before, was a single standing domino, which he'd presumably secreted there on the way out, after showing her the controls. A double five. Two V's, Roman style, him and her. And when she released the brake lever, the movement would inevitably cause that last domino to fall. Make everything, in effect, fall into place right at the last. She had to smile at that. A small, sad smile, but he'd known all along, had foreseen everything, and now she'd show him he was right, if she had the time.
"Hold it!"
a voice barked out suddenly, echoing along the empty platform.
"Stop right there!"
It seemed that, in the end, there was one thing that V hadn't foreseen. Chief Inspector Eric Finch. Looking back, she saw him standing there on the platform outside the train, gun in hand, covering her every move. A tired, battered figure who, having found a trail of bloody footprints and followed them to their end, now looked almost as weary of the world as she was feeling just at that moment.
"You're Evie Hammond, aren't you?"
She made no reply, made no sign of acknowledgement. After all, what was the point of admitting anything this late in the day? It was long past the time to help the police with their inquiries, as the old euphemism for interrogation had it. Keeping her covered, Finch glanced through the window of the train, saw V lying there among the roses, though he wasn't able quite to see what he was lying upon. But he had a pretty good idea of what the train would be packed with. Feelings. Copper's instincts. Always trust that more than expert opinion. He'd been right all along, and they hadn't believed him. Had laughed at him. Not any more.
"Is that?"
he asked, and this time she did nod. No point in denying that, after all.
"Is he dead?"
Finch asked next. But now she found she couldn't answer. It wasn't that she wanted to keep him guessing, keep him wrong-footed in case V suddenly sprang to life again and attacked him. It was because to her, somehow, he was certainly dead, while at the same time he just as certainly wasn't. for V was both a man and an idea, and while the man was dead, the idea would live forever. She'd known that as soon as she decided what she had to do.
Then it's over?
More of a remark than a query, he was obviously taking her silence for confirmation of V's death.
Not quite, she said determinedly,
reaching into the cab and grabbing the brake lever as he approached.
Stop!
He yelled, close enough now to see what she was doing, his voice echoing in the tunnel.
Get your hand off that lever!
He thrust forward the gun then, emphasizing his command, but Evie Hammond had had enough of orders, enough of the police, the government, the society she lived in, of everything, and she'd long ago had enough of fear.
No,
she told him flatly.
No,
said Finch, baffled. He'd known one or two desperate, hardened criminals who'd disobey a direct order at gunpoint, but only one or two. To have a relatively frail young woman standing there and defying him was an entirely new experience. And yet, such obvious self-belief was radiating through her defiance, her determination to overthrow the society that he'd spent his life protecting, that he could only stop and wonder. Truth and justice, they'd always been his watchwords, though justice, he had to admit, had become more than a little compromised in the years since the reclamation, as had he himself. Could she, then, actually have found another truth? A better truth than his, that would somehow restore a real form of justice to the world? And if she had? But then he'd always had a third watchword, too. Duty. And if his ideas of truth and justice were confused, his duty still seemed quite clear.
"I'm sorry, but I've made up my mind,"
she told him calmly, her own sense of duty clearly a match for his own.
"So the only way you're going to stop me is to kill me."
Finch paused then, though the gun remained unwavering. Seeing how determined she was, he realized that another pace forward would undoubtedly have made her release the brake. Words were the only weapon left to him now, if his duty was still to be carried out.
"Why are you doing this?"
he asked, and knew as he said it that it was more than just a case of keeping her talking. He really did want to understand. He'd wanted to understand the way V had thought, but now he never would. And he also wanted to know how that same sort of thinking could spread, infecting someone else. And how far could it spread? Could it even end up infecting him?
"Because he was right," Evie told him with the absolute faith of the recently converted.
"About what?"
"That this country needs more than a building right now," she replied,
still with the same superb calm that he found somehow strangely affecting.
"It needs hope."
Hope. When had he last hoped for anything? Perhaps when he'd joined the party, hoping it would help him get on in his career? Well, it had, but had that really been hope, or just desire? And now that he was confronted with the idea, it seemed to him that hope and desire weren't the same at all. Desire was little more than greed, and he'd seen enough of that in the Norse fire years. Hope was something larger, more all-encompassing, more abstract. What greed was to hope was pretty much what passion was to compassion. And God knew there'd been little enough compassion under Suttler's fascist government. But there was still his duty. Yet here was this woman, whom he was looking at over the barrel of his gun, who seemed to personify the same hope and compassion he'd lost all this time, that he'd always felt had left a gap that he needed to fill, and whose invincible sense of duty seemed far greater than his own. Perhaps, it finally dawned on him, it was because his duty had always been to the force, and the principles enshrined in English law. And what had they done to the English law in the last few decades, with their trials without juries, and their detentions without any trial at all? And if he could finally disentangle all those threads of conspiracy he'd found while carrying out his duty, of Larkhill and St. Mary's, of Creedy and of executed terrorists, could he ever get a verdict in his favour, in the current state of the law? Could he even get the case to court? No, of course he couldn't. In fact, he realized now, it had been foolish ever to think he could. One mention of it, and the black bag would have been over his head in an instant, over Dominic's too, and that of anyone else involved, and they wouldn't even bother with interrogation. He must be getting old, even considering the idea. Was there a greater duty, then, beyond the one he'd always thought he had? And was it embodied here in this girl before him, who, he could see quite plainly now, had never been a terrorist? A duty to finally stop saying, "I was only obeying orders," and obey a much higher principle, to overthrow the entire world order itself. It was Sutler's Norsefire party and their goddamned reclamation that had taken Jane and Peter from him all those years ago. Not directly, perhaps, but if they hadn't started the trouble that led to the riots, the street fighting, and if he hadn't been so busy working on the party's behalf, trying to contain that trouble, she wouldn't have had to go out to the few remaining open shops, taking Peter with her because she didn't want to leave him alone, and the car wouldn't have run into... "It's time," Evie said then, and smiled so sweetly at him he really just didn't know what to do. She did, though, and released the brake lever, stepping away from the cab. And the last domino fell, its single click an epitaph to a man with no identity, and all the ideas and plans he'd taken with him to his grave, ideas that lived on, and a plan that would come to fruition as his final memorial. And Eric Finch had absolutely no idea what to do then, his body almost dead with fatigue, his mind alive with conflict, except to slowly lower his gun and watch the train silently ease forward into the tunnel. So gently, at first, it seemed there'd still be time to call it back. But by the time he'd realized what he'd done, the cab had disappeared into the tunnel, and there was no way now it would ever be stopped. And V was going with it. Into the darkness. The final darkness. There seemed no point in doing anything else except putting the gun back in his pocket, forgetting he even had it, and letting the world take its course. No point in arresting the girl before him. No point in trying to raise a warning. No point in trying to save a government he realized that he no longer believed in, had never really believed in, but had accepted because it was the only one they had. That would be fallen completely by the morning. And when he realized he didn't care at all, he felt an overwhelming sense of relief. Still bewildered as to what he'd done and what, in the long run, was likely to happen as a consequence, Finch could only stand there as Evie stepped forward. Taking his arm gently and smiling like a daughter that he'd never had, she began to lead him away slowly toward the stairs. "Tell me," she said almost affectionately, remembering another time when someone else had said much the same to her. "Do you like music, Mr. Finch?" Around Parliament Square, more and more V's were materialising from the shadows, and no longer from just one direction. They came along Millbank, they streamed past the Abbey, they gathered on the other side of the Thames over Westminster Bridge. They came along Whitehall, which was supposed to have been closed off, along with all its side streets, all the way back to Trafalgar Square, and as they did so they even passed by Downing Street, in an ultimate show of defiance. "General?" Dowland asked Bird uncertainly, desperately needing guidance, but equally desperately hoping the order he dreaded wouldn't come. It did. "Ready at arms!" General Bird yelled, and there was a murmur of quiet voices, a clatter as automatic weapons were checked and raised to shoulders. Even so, it was all done with a certain hesitancy. For by then there were more of them, and still they came. From hundreds to thousands, and then thousands more, packing the streets in a vast ocean of humanity.
"What do we do?"
Lieutenant Dowland asked again, looking at them with a sense of rising panic.
"Jesus bloody Christ!"
said Bird quietly, finally realizing that if they moved forward, as they certainly would at the first outbreak of gunfire, there were far too many of the masked horde for his men to shoot before the human tidal wave broke over them. And when it came right down to it, the masked figures weren't representing any immediate threat. They were standing and waiting, expectant, hopeful. And every single one of them was smiling. And then, softly at first, the music began to play,
swelling from the loudspeakers on the street corners, just as it had done a year ago, on the Old Bailey's night of pyrotechnic glory. Music that somehow saved General Byrd from having to issue an order he would have regretted for the rest of his life, that soon grew loud enough that it would have drowned out that order anyway. Different music this time, though, and even more apt, chosen especially for the occasion, for the 5th of November. Handel's Firework Music. Not far away, Evie had led a still rather confused Inspector Finch up from the station and through the shadow gallery, hurrying him on gently and hardly giving him time to look at the wonders it contained. Even so, that brief glance revealed to him so many other worlds beyond the narrow one he'd known, so many things he suddenly remembered with surprise and frank delight. He knew that one day he'd wish to see them all restored. And then ushering him into the elevator that would take them up to the roof, that same rooftop where she'd stood naked in the rain on the night that she'd rediscovered her real self, feeling, somehow, that Finch, too, was about to arrive at the same sort of revelatory conclusion. Though if she'd asked, he would have had to admit that in the immediate present he merely felt weary, directionless, and far older than his years. It was time to go, he thought, to leave the work of rebuilding the future to younger hands, like those of Dominic Stone and this Hammond girl beside him.
"That music," he said,
hearing it now as they emerged into the open air.
"Yes, his music," Evie told him,
hardly wanting to imply that it was anyone else's than Handel's, but knowing that V would have arranged this, some automatic switch tripping as soon as the train began its final journey.
"It's beautiful, isn't it?"
She stepped away from Finch, moving toward the parapet and raising her hands just as V had done a year ago tonight when the tune had been all of heroic resistance, as if now she were conducting Handel's marvellous, celebratory music as its power increased by the second. Deep below the ground, V's brilliantly painted, rose-filled, hell-bound train reached its final destination, hit a mass of concrete blocks, and did exactly what a train full of gelignite might be expected to do. And on the surface, directly above, the Houses of Parliament erupted in flame and fury, in smoke and smashed masonry, as Augustus Pugin's elaborately decorated exterior was blown apart from within, shattered into millions of stone fragments even before the wood and other interior features added fuel to the fire. And then the great clock tower tilted, and deposited Big Ben into the churning waters of the Thames, throwing up a pillar of water that almost matched the flames in height, as the building blossomed into a great orange funeral pyre. A pyre on which burned the last remains of the government, and the Norse Fire Party, of England's fascist interlude, of a thousand plots and conspiracies, of histories and fictions that Finch had never quite managed to disentangle, and knew that now he never would, and no longer cared besides. A funeral pyre on which burned the last remains of V.
"Who was he?"
Finch asked then, stepping up to the parapet to join Evie.
"He was Edmond Dantès,"
she said softly, glancing round to see his slightly puzzled look, and added,
"And he was my father, and my mother, my brother, and my friend. He was you and me. He was all of us."
All of us, thought Finch, and realized that the state had no business oppressing its own people, for ultimately the state is the people. And in the end, he knew, only people are real, and everything else, politics, conspiracies, the state itself, are all fictions, all stories made up by people as a way of organizing their lives. The truth about Larkhill? What did it matter in the end? Only the people who'd lived and died there were important, and what they'd done for good or ill. And now the night's events had brought the whole story to an end. But would they write rhymes about this in the future? And if they went back to burning an effigy each year on this night, whose face would now be hidden by the mask? Evie stood there contemplatively for a few seconds longer, then turned toward Finch and smiled.
"No one will ever forget this night," she told him, or what it means to this country. And then, turning away once more for a last private thought, she added, "But I will never forget the man, and what he meant to me." And as the ceremonies were brought to a conclusion, by a large eruption of fireworks exploding in the air and forming once again the letter V, the assembled crowds began to take off their masks, to lose their anonymity, to become once again the selves they'd been before the long years of repression had imposed quite other masks upon them. For this time, the letter V quite plainly stood for victory. This concludes the reading of V for Vendetta by Steve Moore, based on the graphic novel illustrated by David Lloyd and published by Vertigo DC Comics, based on the screenplay written by the Wachowski brothers. Copyright 2005 by DC Comics. This book was read by Simon Vance. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with DC Comics and was produced in 2006 by Blackstone Audio Incorporated, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio Incorporated. If you would like to obtain a complete catalogue of our titles or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD and MP3 CD, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.